questions or what do you want to
do? I don't know, I just... You'd like me to talk about Ruth. I'd like to know how you knew her, in what context, and what you would do with that in a way. Yes. And how the Joburg lift operated. Mm. Those are things that I don't have from writing.
My memory is foul. But I'll try and start... Well, I married my husband when he was the National Secretary of the Springbok Legion, and then I...
That would have been the early 40s.
Yeah. Mm. That would. Well, we were together in 1943. We married in 45. We were both married, and we had to get divorces. And then I went to work for the Springbok Legion. I was in the Army, in the Air Force, actually, in Cape Town. And then I left and I married Jack and I started work in the Springbok Legion. I became a fundraiser. I'd been a nurse before that. It was a big jump for me, politically and every other way. And then, of course, I started to move around in those circles, right? And I became more politically active later, after the Springbok Legion wound up, which is what they did. Jack then became the first secretary, National Secretary of the Congress of Democrats. And I moved over then to work for the Congress of Democrats. And then he was banned, and then Cecil Williams was the next secretary, was banned, and then I became the secretary. Not because I fitted the role, but because there was no bloody body else at that time. And then I was banned in 1954. In 1956, of course, my husband and Ruth and Joe were in the treason trial. I suppose around then, I became closer to Ruth than I had been before. I didn't really. Well, of course, I knew her because we'd both been in the party. And I worked in the party office for a short time as well. But I wasn't really that close to Ruth until about 56. And I got to know her well. As I worked then for the Treason Trial Defence Fund and then for the Defence and Aid Fund. That was from 61 when the Treason Trial Fund wound up.
There was a Reverend Pinnock in there, if I remember.
There was a who?
A Reverend Pinnock.
Yes, you're related, aren't you?
Yes.
That's right. Yes, I remember.
Have you found what happened to him?
No, I don't know either. Somebody reminded me, actually. I had forgotten completely. Mm. I remembered Reverend Thompson, you know, but I didn't remember Pinnock. But I dare say he was, when I first met Ruth, I was totally overawed by her. And I think many people were. First of all, I mean, she was brilliant. I thought of her when I first met her as a blue stocking. And she wasn't very, she didn't care very much then. Her hair was very curly. And she didn't use makeup and she was dressed well. But she didn't care very much about, I didn't think she cared about how she looked and so on. She didn't have a very good image of herself in those days as a woman. I mean, she always had it up there and she knew what she had up there. But she overawed me completely. I was terrified of her, and as I say, many people were. I spent many, many years subsequently defending Ruth to other friends, because I think I learned early on that she had great vulnerability. She was a very vulnerable woman. And she was a very shy woman, and she was a very private woman. And she hid herself, you know. Part of her image was these dark glasses she always wore. And that was a kind of a hiding behind them. I remember one night we were going out to something, some do or other. And Ruth was getting dressed, and I remember saying to her then, let me put some eyeshadow on you. And she was quite appalled, you know. But she let me do it, and she liked the effect very much. And it wasn't long after that that we came out. She then started to have her hair straightened, and then I'm sure she was at the hairdresser twice a week, at least, you know, because she had that. Ethel de Kaiser's got the same thing about that, you know, hair must be straight, not curly. And then she became much more stylish in her clothes and her...
When was that change?
It was round about then, yeah. That's my recollection, you know, because I don't remember being very friendly. I remember one action of hers before that struck me very much. She and Hilda Bernstein were organizing, I think it must have been a peace conference or a peace something. And neither of them were women who would be bothered with the detail of a conference, the feeding of the delegates, and it was mainly African women, and the decorations of the hall, all sorts of things that have to be done, but that was not their baby, you know. And they asked me to do it. For some reason, I had time around then, and I did it. And I think they were very happy with the results. And Ruth bought me my very first bottle of really expensive perfume, and I've never forgotten that. It was beautiful perfume, it was Guerlain. And she had that kind of touch. It was always very stylish in her presence that she gave, or whatever, you know. Of course, she came from a well-off background, as you know, her parents were well-off, and they were never short of money. And she had wonderful taste, different from anybody else. I mean, her curtains had to be blue and green, you know, and a combination that nobody else, royal blue and green, that nobody else would dream of them. It was marvellous. She would buy these wild paintings in Tanzania, you know, these bright, brilliant things that nobody had ever seen before, and she had those all over her walls in London, I recollect. Things like that. She had style and taste and after good things, and she loved, for example, there were three things Ruth really loved. One of them was good shoes. She had difficult, long, narrow feet. And she loved expensive Italian shoes. She loved expensive and good luggage. Luggage was a very important part of Ruth's life. Had to be like that. And she always wore silk shirts. I know when I went to stay with her in Mozambique, I said to her, but how can you, in this heat, how can you wear so much? And he wore silk shirts, you know, that was. And she had a problem, I think. She had what's goiter related to? Yes, some thyroid problem. And there were periods in her life when she put on a lot of weight, and that troubled her tremendously. But I think it was controlled in the latter years that I knew her. Certainly, the last 20 years, it was controlled. But she worried very much about putting on weight.
Did she actually put on weight in the 50s from time to time?
Yes, she did. She did. And she hated it. She absolutely hated it. She was a very organized person. Now, you would think a woman like that wouldn't be able to really run a home. I mean, you know, you think of brilliant women not being that, but somehow she had the same style in her kitchen, in her, you know, the last years in England, we always spent Christmas with them. My husband and I always went there on Christmas Day, and Ruth just had everything perfect, the ducks going in the oven with the cherries, and, you know, the oranges on the tray, and with the silver, and everything, you know, beautifully done. So she had I think intelligent people are organized, and not only organized, but they're, capable, you know. And then she was a great person for doing lists, you know, just do a list and everything would get done. When she went to write The Barrel of a Gun, she went to Africa, and Joe was away. They had a flat here in London. and her before they bought their house, and her mother and father were living somewhere else, and she asked my husband and I to come and stay with the three girls. Sean was then 14, and she drew me a list. You draw a list then, you know, abracadabra. It's all good. Of course it didn't. Nothing worked really. I mean, she told me the oven does this, that and the other. I remember one Sunday morning, her mother, War and Peace was on. There was a special show in here. And she took me and we put on, as per Ruth's instructions in the oven, I did a roast beef, a Yorkshire pudding, potatoes and apple pie. So thing would take so long, we'd come back, everything would be cooked as per the oven that you switch on, and it's a timer. Came home half an hour later, I think, or maybe an hour later. It was just, you know, tragedy, that lunch. However,
why do you think she was so private? Because people, when she doesn't sound that private and shy.
Because I think she was very shy, and I think she was very, she didn't feel secure in many ways, Ruth. That's why I was always defending her. I mean, my husband, for example, you see, I think in a certain way Ruth deboiled men, and I think the reason she did was because she was much cleverer than most of them, or most of these political giants, you know. He thought they were political giants. And now my husband was a particularly interesting and lovely man. But Ruth did something, she wasn't feminine enough in a certain way. Until he really got to know her in Swaziland during the emergency.
Was he with her?
He escaped, yes, and in fact he brought her back secretly and took her to the hiding place where she was in Joburg, where I went to meet her, which she was like underground then. And he got to love Ruth, and she got to love him too, because he recognized all the things I'm telling you, her vulnerability, her, you know. Before that he thought, ah, she's just this brilliant woman who poo-poos everybody and rides everybody down. I mean, she did that particularly, I think, to men who feared her in a certain way. You know, times were different, people were different then, men and women were different then. There wasn't the society now where a lot of the sexism is broken down. It was much more defined, you know. I don't think she did it on purpose. She didn't suffer fools. And she didn't suffer, if she didn't like anybody, for usually for good reason, not for trivial reasons. I mean, Ruth was not a trivial or a petty person. She was a big person. She didn't like people for good reason, if they were liars or dishonest in any way, politically or in any other way. That was it. And you see, I admired that quality in her. My husband, again, I quote him because it was his particular expression. Unprincipled cordiality, he called it. He had it in a big way. And Ruth just simply, that she didn't like that person, she showed it. She no way of not wearing her heart on her sleeve, you know. It was always there and it was visible and it showed. If she didn't like you, that was it. And I think many people therefore resented her. But she didn't hide it. She was not a hypocrite.
Why do you think men particularly, was she breaking down sexual stereotypes?
Oh, very much so. Oh, very much. Ruth was a big feminist. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I remember very well, we went once to a women's meeting here in England. And it was a big public meeting, and she didn't speak from the platform that night. Pity. Because she was a brilliant speaker, brilliant, you know. And somebody said from the platform, that in the Soviet Union now, 75% of the women, of the doctors are women, and how they've broken down, you know, this, that and the other. So, came to time for people to get up from the floor to speak, and Ruth got up. And she said, yes, it's all very true about what you're saying about the Soviet Union, and it's true that women have gone a long way there, but you show me on that presidium with all those men in their double-breasted suits where there's a woman, then I'll say they've broken it down. And there was just, you know, like that, everybody gawking, you see, in the hall. Yes, she was a great feminist, and I remember one night, that was the beginning of breaking my husband down in a certain way. He made some... Look, my husband was 10 years older than I was, and he came from a very poor working class family, and he went to work when he was 13, and he went through the Depression in a terrible way. I mean, he did... the things he did, you know. He ran for, pegged for diamond digging in Lichtenberg, and he worked in a butcher shop, and he, Christ knows what, painted up there. I mean, he really worked in the Depression as a young man, you know. So I'm trying to explain his background. Therefore, you understand that it wasn't easy to, in the home, there was no sexism with Jack. I mean, he cooked in the kitchen the same as I would. He brought up my child, I mean, better than me, in fact, because when I married him, I couldn't cook at all. And he brought up our child, he did everything, you know, which husbands are that particular. Hello, Eddie.
Sorry,
hello, darling. How nice to see you. All my best friends are here tonight.
Mm.
How are you, love?
More better for seeing you.
Right.
We're going...
Where was I?
Jack and...
Yeah, and so... I mean, I didn't think there was anything wrong with telling jokes about women in those days, you know. And Jack made some joke. It was just about the rise of, you know, women's lip. And she laid into him. She laid into him. She lambasted him. She gave him such a tongue lashing. Didn't know what he'd done. But the next day he went out and he bought Germaine Greer's book. And he bought another book and he sat down, and Jack was a great reader, and he read. He never ever made another joke about women again, you know. Ruth put him in his bloody place, well and truly. So. Yeah, so.
Rika, what I'm trying to find out really are the, almost the daily rhythms of her life. I mean, I know that you people knew pretty well socially.
Look, she loved to let her hair down. She loved a party. She loved going out and enjoying herself. She loved holidays. I've got a copy of... I've got a copy of Vogue magazine in my car. Just by the way, in which there was an interview with Sean. Ruth would love to know she made Vogue. Jesus, she would love that. And Sean got a very good interview, and with pictures, and in it is a little picture like that, where she, Joe, my husband, myself, the Buntings, and Turops were on holiday in Cape Town. It must have been perhaps just after they were, yes, I think just after they were acquitted in the treason trial. And we went to a very nice restaurant in Constantia. And it's a wonderful picture of Ruth, and there's another couple of lovely pictures of her in that thing. Very stylish. September Vogue. I've got it in the car. I'll show it to you. I'll get it in a minute. I meant to bring it in. I've forgotten.
So
looking
through the newspapers.
Look, I think Ruth was, I had some affairs too. I mean, I'm sure she did. Now, I went to Mozambique in 1979. I went to Mozambique in 1978. I was on a special mission for Defence and Aid Fund, who I worked for here. It was the year of the child, and I went to visit the camps in Africa. Mozambique was one of the places I went to visit a ZANU camp. So the next year, a film team in Holland called VARA wanted to make a film of a ZANU camp, children's camp. So every year in Holland they have a special night, a Nikras night, when they raise money for children. It used to be for deprived kids in Holland, but for many years they didn't need it, so they did it for other causes. And the director, a chap called Jan de Croft, phoned me up and said, since I'd been there the year before and they wanted to do it that year for to put the money through Defence and Aid Fund for the camps, for children's camps in exile, political camps, liberation, yeah, organisation camps, would I come with them to Mozambique? I said, well, but I don't know anything about bloody filming. No, but because I had contacts, etc., they thought I would make it easier for them. So since the money was coming to us, the organisation agreed I'd go with them. And we arrived in Mozambique, and I don't know if you've travelled much in the third world, but right. So we got there, and it was just all hell. I mean, we didn't get off that bloody airport for about 3 hours. I kept phoning Pam Dos Santos, my friend. I couldn't get hold of her. Eventually I got her. She said, Christ, are you still there? I mean, I'll see that somebody comes for you immediately. And eventually, after a hell of a long time, they arrived. There was only a van big enough to take one person and all the film gear, and the other three, that was the cameraman and the sound man and me, were left sitting on the bloody tarmac outside. And they booked for the Palana Hotel from Holland, you see. Well, the next, after another hour or two, he came back with a driver. The Palana Hotel knew nothing. They never received the telex or God knows what. And he said, Jesus Christ, we're in a real flea hole of a hotel, you see. Well, I'm the sort of person that, you know, I can more or less sleep anywhere. It doesn't bother me much. I mean, if you've been to jail, you know, all these things don't matter much. But when I saw that hotel and I saw the room, I mean, it was filthy, filthy. I'm sure there were bugs crawling around. I said, no, I'm sorry, I don't know what you boys do. I can't sleep in this hotel. So I picked up the phone and I phoned Ruth. And I mean, in the instant, you know, she said, I'm coming for you, just don't worry. And this guy said to me, who did you phone? Ruth first, did you say? I said, yes. He said, good God, you don't tell me I'm going to meet Ruth. Now, he was a very attractive man, and he was, I suppose, at least 10 years her junior. Very nice guy. The Dutch guy.
Frank.
De Croft.
Frank.
Who did you say?
Frank.
No. Frank. Oh, no, Frank is somebody else. Frank's a Swedish guy. No. De Croft. And, you know, Ruth came for us and took us to her. She always had such a lovely place. Always the style was just lovely. And, well, she could afford it, you know. But it was lovely. And she, you know, we had a party. I mean, we had a party straight away. And this guy just fell for her hook, line, and sinker, you know. And of course she loved it. I mean, I'm not saying anything can. I'm sure there was never a minute's opportunity in that trip we were on for her to have an affair with Jan de Croft. But I think it was possible. Sorry. Jan de Croft certainly would have been very interested, you know. And I think, well, it was really flattering to any woman, you know, a man 10 years younger. And he was a very lovely man. men were attracted to Ruth on here first, what was here. And from then on, nothing else mattered. I mean, she was beautiful in a certain way. If you looked at her features, except for her eyes, and she had lovely hair, none of them were really beautiful. She didn't have good legs. She didn't exactly have a good, beautiful figure, especially in those days when figures were something else again, you know, and where those kind of things mattered where they don't matter today. Do you know what I mean? And she wore glasses, and, you know. But once a man made it up here with Ruth, then they were gone. I mean, that was it. You see what I'm trying to say, yeah.
Why do you think she was so insecure?
Because I think she was not a pretty girl. She was not a beautiful girl. And they're all girls. I mean, you see, today it's so much easier. With having broken down a lot of those sexist aspects, it's so much easier for women to relate to men. It wasn't so easy then. You had to bloody well be beautiful to relate in some kind of a way. I think that was one of the reasons. I think because she was a shy girl. She wasn't sure of herself with men. Only later.
What was Julius like?
Oh, he was a sweet man, yes. He was a sweet man. He was very sweet.
How did she relate to him?
That's interesting. You see, her mother and her were very much alike.
I met Tilly.
Hmm? You met Tilly, yes. Very much alike. Both very tough and very intellectual and very, definite and this, that and the other. Julius was sweet and soft and not very... you wouldn't call him an intellectual giant. I mean, far from it. Far from it. But he was a nice, kind man. I think she was very fond of him. But only she had a very high regard for him, you know? Certainly she was very upset when he died. I mean, that I know because she came here with Joe and they were having problems with kids then. Robin was having other problems and Sean and her always had these problems. Of course, Robin by then was already living with Andy. And she needed a place. Their house was let and Tilly's flat was below their house. She didn't want to move in with Tilly. She needed to be alone with her kids. So I moved out of my flat and gave them my flat for 2 weeks. And I saw quite a bit of her during that 2 weeks. And, you know, she was very, very cut up about Julius's death. Tilly, of course, just admired and adored her, you know. And so did Julius. I mean, they both did.
Tilly seemed to have done much of the mothering of the children.
Julius?
Tilly,
yes, she did. Oh, she did. She did. And that was certainly very important. Well, obviously, I mean, Ruth needed that crutch, you know, because she had all these important things to do. As you saw in the film. And even after, I mean, here in England, when she went off to do this thing, I mean, I stayed with the kids for how long? It was quite a long period, some 6 weeks maybe, or something like that. She told me when she left, Sean is going to be 14 and she can have a birthday party. And she can invite 20 kids to the flat. Okay. So comes the day of the party. Number one, Sean doesn't want the two younger ones there. They've got to go off and stay with Tilly. Number two, no food. Don't have food at parties. No food, no drink, nothing. Okay. Having a party, no food, nothing, no drink. So I come home from work and Tilly's organised chip crisps and peanuts or something and beer and cider. And I was quite annoyed about that. I said, I thought they were too bloody young at 14. Tilly said, come on, Rika, don't be square, not like you, you know. I said, all right, okay, on your own head here. Well, Jack and I decided to take the two younger kids off to a show and then drop them at Tilly by 11, or we'd be home by 11, you see. And 12 o'clock we decided the party would be over. It's enough at 14. And Sean was a young 14. He wasn't an old 14. She wasn't like this kid you've just seen here, who has never been 14. Never been young. Anyway, we get home and open the door, and I couldn't believe what I saw. I mean, the place was just chock-a-block. Chock-a-block, I mean, talk about it. Jack said, I didn't notice, but he said he thought he saw such a sign of relief on Sean's face. And all ages, I mean, they must have gone up to 25, never mind 14. And we stopped. It was my first experience of a party in this country, you see. We started to walk upstairs. The bedrooms were upstairs. And the kids, the language, I mean, I'm no prude, but my goodness, I mean, I thought with two old people walking up the steps, have a little knocked on your life. I mean, the language was something else. We got upstairs into Prude's bedroom where we were sleeping, and the bed looked well used by then. And everything had been open. Now, Ruth didn't lock a thing away. She had beautiful jewellery, not again, everything was, you know, Ruth liked silver. She didn't like gold, for example. She had lovely things, and they would be real, but, you know. And lovely perfume. I could see the bedroom, the bathroom, everything had been opened, looked at, pulled out, examined, you know, perfumes everywhere. I thought, oh shit, I hope all, I mean, I didn't have an inventory on what she had there, or, you know, so. One mother had phoned me during the day to say, will the party be supervised? And I said, well, I don't know what you mean by supervision, but we're coming home at 11 and the party will be over by 12. She said, that's all right. She said, you see, my daughter said she's Sean's best friend, she's sleeping over. I said, okay, that's fine. Don't worry. So the next thing, I hear a door locking across. There were three bedrooms. Two bedrooms. The two youngest ones slept in one, and Sean had her own bedroom. I said to my husband, oh Christ, I can't have a locked bedroom door with 14-year-olds. I mean, I better go and investigate. I felt terrible. I knocked on the door tentatively, and it was this girl whose mother had phoned, very lovely girl. She opened the door. She had five boys in there. And I said to her, listen, darling, what you do at home is your business. But here, just don't lock any doors. And I want to know what's happening. Anyway, it came 12 o'clock. Jack went down and read the riot act and said goodbye to everybody. And there were 12 girls left. I said, but what are you all doing here? They said, well, we can't get home. You can't chuck out 12 young girls, you know. So I said, well, what about your parents? They said, no, our parents, they know we're sleeping over. Well, there was only one phone call I'd had. So I said, well, okay. I mean, it was a comfortable lounge and a nice thick carpeting and big couches and chairs. You can all sleep down here or upstairs. No, they'll all sleep down. Okay. All right, I said, good night. Yeah, have a good night. Oh my God, next thing I hear boys' voices downstairs. So Jack went down quite angry by now. He was very tired. My husband was a very sick man by now. And I wanted to sleep, you see. So he went down. He was very rude to the boys. He said he was pulling them out from all behind curtains, from the balcony, from under furniture and so on. Chucked them out. He said he kicked one guy right out the place. And then I had wonderful parties, absolutely wonderful parties. We had wonderful food and we had masses of booze and wonderful music and we danced like hell. And, you know, they were mixed parties, of course, all of them. They were just wonderful. And quite a couple of them I remember at Ruth's place, at least two, if not three, I remember at her house. Even 50s.
What would you do, dance?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, when I said I didn't know Ruth well before, of course, I knew her from the City Hall steps in the 40s. The Communist Party meetings
on
the steps.
Tell me what she would do there.
She was a speaker. She was always a speaker. I was a spectator.
What sort of subjects would she speak on?
Well, I mean, then it was the anti-fascist thing, you know, because the fascists were coming... you know, the Nationalist Party were coming up into power then. I'm talking before 48 now, huh? And, you know, the brown shirts used to, the black shirts, whoever, I mean, and the police, I mean, we were always having, I used to go, I remember being pregnant and going and thinking, Christ, I hope they don't, you know, injure me. And I used to take a long hatpin, that was my weapon, you know. But, I mean, the fist fight was terrible, dreadful. And, of course, I remember this particular thing when the Nationalists, when Milan was having this huge meeting in the City Hall, and the Springbok Legion organized this thing. They had a banner across Loveday Street where he had to come under, which said Traitor's Gate, and it came right over, you know, where they had... And of course the Springbok Legion stopped that meeting. I mean, Milan and them had to get us crawl out the back door. So they took their revenge on us, you know. I remember those meetings. I mean, I was terrified every Sunday night I went to a meeting. I was terrified out of my mind. But I went, you
know.
What
time did they start?
I can't remember if it was 7 or 8. I'm inclined to think 8, but it could have been 7. I don't remember. And I remember these fights, and I have one wonderful memory of this. He was a big, burly chap. He was a Yugoslav who was in the army in South Africa. And I remember him picking up this. I was in the audience, and I was watching this, and I saw him pick up this chap. And this chap was screaming blue murder, and I couldn't imagine why. Of course, Buddy Schwimm was squeezing him where it hurts most, you know. And I remember all sorts of things, like a guy with a guardian hitting somebody over the head, and the guy went down. There was a bottle wrapped in the guardian, you know. And I remember those sort of things, and Ruth was always one of the speakers there, unruffled, you know, she would just go straight ahead and speak. Yes, I think mainly on Communist Party policy and against fascism, I mean, that was the...
In the 40s, when she was speaking on the City Hall steps, was she considered very central to the party at that stage?
I think so, yes.
She was in the Young Communist League.
Yes, no, I would have thought so. And I have a vague recollection of her going off to a youth conference in Hungary or something, yeah, that I remember. And Tilly went off, her mother, in 19... Was it 51 to China? I think it was 51 that Tilly went to China, brought me back the most wonderful piece of jade.
What sort of music did you listen to? Odd question, but I mean, what sort of music did you dance to?
Kwela music, mainly. You know, I was the secretary of the King Kong Committee, amongst other things. It was another thing I was involved in. Yes, Kwela music, mainly.
And how was it played at the party? Live or...?
No. It was on records, I would imagine. Tapes, I think, were not on then, but records were mainly the thing, yeah.
And who came to those parties?
Well, I mean, I remember the whole treason trial coming to those parties and their wives and friends and, you know, others and so on. And, of course, every year, for many years, my husband and I went to Cape Town on holiday in December. Sometimes Ruth and Joe were there. And the Buntings had a New Year's party every night, every New Year's Eve at their house, in which everybody who was anyone in the movement was there. I mean, there were usually a couple of hundred people. And they were just the most fantastic. And we used to stay with the Buntings, so I know remember very well because Brian is a fanatic about cleaning up after a party. So I remember sort of 5 o'clock in the morning cleaning a window, you know. And I usually used to make the soup for those parties or something like that. Yeah.
And what would Ruth or your group really do at weekends? These are the places that I don't know about. I mean, what did you do on Sundays?
Well, I was a great swimmer. I was a great sports person myself. And we went to Hilda Bernstein, for example, had a swimming pool. Lots of other friends of ours had pools. No, not lots, but some others had pools. And certainly for me, swimming was, you know, going for a swim and sunbathe. I've got a sun cancer, which is a result of all that. I've had several operations, plastic and so on. My nose is from here. So Ruth wasn't such an outdoor type, you know. I don't know what Ruth did very much the weekends, but we sometimes had picnics. Yes, she loved a picnic, I remember that. And she always said food tasted so much better in the open air. When we came to London, I remember we first, the four of us, with, I think Sylvester Stain was one who came with us, and his new girlfriend he's now married to. And the Burmans, I think, may have been there. We went to somewhere on the river. No, I think it's up. Somewhere on the river. And we had she loved picnics, yes. And always very elegant food and wine. And she'd have goat's cheese. And you have to eat goat's cheese with pears. Or apples, I can't remember. But, you know, that was Ruth. Beautiful and always very elegant. And we would decide beforehand who would bring which food, you know, I would do this and she would do that and so on. Yes, she loved picnics. She wasn't a great outdoor girl, you know, sports person, but she did come to some of those weekend.
Was she considered a bit of a workaholic?
Oh yes, she is. I mean, look, when I stayed with her in Mozambique, because I didn't carry on with that story, I stayed with her in her flat, and the men stayed on in this grotty hotel until we could go up to this camp in Tete province. And she gave me Olive Schreiner to read then in the manuscript form, and every morning at 6 o'clock she was at that typewriter.
What was she writing then?
She was doing the Olive Schreiner thing, it was the finishing, you know. And she would be typing like hell. And then she would rush off to work. And at every lunchtime, she came home with somebody. She had a working lunch at home. It wasn't chat, it wasn't social, it was a working lunch that she brought somebody back from Frelimo or whoever, what. She had a manservant then in Mozambique. But she loved salads, Ruth. It was some lovely salad. Something, little something. It was always very elegant and small and lovely and nice. Nice food, nice bit of cheese, nice bit of this and that and that.
Was she like that in the 1950s as well?
She was always like that. I mean, Ruth was always working like hell. Have you met Wolfie, by the way, yet?
I'm going to meet him on Friday.
Oh, well, he'll tell you a lovely story, which I won't tell you because it's his special story about Ruth, so I won't mention that one.
Perhaps he'll forget.
No, he won't. I'm sure he won't. I don't want to spoil it for him. He's a bit deaf, by the way. He doesn't know it or he doesn't admit to it, so you better talk up a bit. Was she like that in the 50s? Was she always working? Yes, she was always working.
Was she producing?
Always working.
Huge number of stories for The Guardian. I can't believe how many stories.
She worked like hell. And of course, because if you've got a... Look, if you're a me and you've got to sit down and write something, it can take you 3 hours. But Ruth could do that, no doubt, in 20 minutes or half an hour. You see, she was brilliant. And she had the capacity, and she had the knowledge, and she had the vocabulary, and she had everything. And she had a memory, you know, I mean, everything was... She nearly got me in bloody jail once. That's not her fault.
How was it?
Oh, and it's another story, really. It doesn't really relate to Ruth. It only relates to her pamphlet on the potato farm.
Bethel
scandal, yeah. But it's not really related to her. It's just her pamphlet that was nearly got me into trouble.
So how was she considered in the movement? As a journalist or as an activist?
She's considered as a politician first and a journalist second, certainly. I would have thought so. Oh.
If she was considered a politician, what organizations was she focusing on?
The Communist Party.
So that was her key organization?
Yes.
What about things like COD?
And she didn't, yes, she was also a member of COD. Yes. I don't know how active she was in COD. I don't know if she saw COD as her problem. Youth, I mean, for a long time she was in the YCL and youth. Ruth was never a woman. Quotes, if you know what I mean. Women's organizations were not her forte. I told her once that she was the student princess, you know, she was a student forever. But youth was, a big thing.
How long would she have continued her YCL work?
No, I can't tell you that. I don't, you know, that recollection is
beyond the 1940s.
Well, she went, when did she go to that youth conference and with Catherine? In 1949, was it?
40 something.
At meetings to do something I would have loved to have had. She wore these dark glasses.
Even at meetings?
Well, she never took her... They were her spectacles, but they went... They were always dark, you see. And she would... She used to get terribly flat by 8 o'clock. Right down. It might have been part of this thyroid thing. She always had this quite badly, you see. And she would go to sleep. You couldn't see that she was sleeping. She was very quiet sleeping. Sit and sleep very quietly. But as soon as there was anything that was contentious, she woke up like a bullet. She never missed it. Well, I thought that was a fantastic capacity to have. And the other thing I admired and liked about Ruth, and I think that's why Ruth liked me, didn't matter how unpopular her point of view was, if that's what she believed, that's what she stuck to. And for a long time she was very critical of the Soviet Union. And you well know, it's not a secret, that the party didn't agree couldn't have. That was another reason why Ruth was unpopular amongst many people.
For her not taking a pro-Soviet...
That's right. She was very critical of Stalin when others were not prepared to be.
Now, was that later or was it already early?
Well, I don't know how early, but it certainly went back to the 60s.
That would have put her at a bit of in opposition to Joe.
It did. Sure did. It sure did.
Because Joe's a Moscow man.
Yeah. It sure did. With my husband, too. It was a very hard life. But despite that, you see, he had a huge regard and respect for her, so did Joe, for her intellect.
Yeah. I always find it interesting that of the great tours that happened, even in the 40s and 50s, many people went, like Brian Bunting went to the Soviet Union, Ruth went to China.
Mm.
And in her writing, much of her journalism is about the rural affairs, about passes, about Bethel, whereas Brian was about international politics. And even then, the differences were obvious. I mean, the relationship between China and her interest in rural affairs was very obvious.
She didn't fancy Brian very much, or Michael Harmon.
Well, she would have considered them hardliners.
But so is my husband a hardliner. I've got on extremely well with him. Oh, so was Jo. She had to find another way around to like somebody, you know. I mean, at least they were honest and she could argue with them and they could agree to disagree finally, you know. But I think with some people, she didn't. Didn't have much rapport. I went with her once to Rome to a conference, 1970, when Cabral was the main speaker.
Oh, marvelous. Gosh, I have a lot of regard for Cabral.
Totally, yeah. But I want to tell you, it was one hell of a woman, I met him at a conference earlier, when I was a lot younger. I had one hard time with him. But he was a beautiful, wonderful man, no doubt about it. Anyway, I've never been to Rome before. There were several of us who went to this conference. And the first day, we didn't have anything on. And we went off. And Ruth said, Rika, the first place I'm taking you to is this wonderful shoe shop, the Trevi Steps, Trevi Fountains, where I never miss going, you see. And she was so right. I mean, I needed a pair of sandals desperately. It was as hot as hell. And we went in and we bought our sandals and we then took off for a wonderful walk around Rome. And she had a man friend there, whose name I don't know. And that man was mad about her, and I know she was having an affair with him, but I don't know who he was, so I can't tell you, and he did. And he met us that night and took us to St. Peter's Square. He took us to a most wonderful restaurant. And then, you know, I was with Ruth at the conference and we went back together. It was the only conference I ever was at with her.
Nikki, just to drop back into the 1950s, which is my passion, what were you involved in there, apart from the Springbok Legion and the Cod? The party?
Not terribly involved with the party. I mean, I never got up there. Now, I'm essentially a backroom girl.
Was Ruth? Sorry, I was going to say, was Ruth the only person within the sort of inner circle of the party who was
involved? No, I'm sure Hilda Bernstein was. Ray Alexander, I'm sure, was from Cape Town.
Sorry, I was asking you about what you were involved.
Yeah. Well, I was involved with King Kong. That was in the 1950s, very much. I have someone, if you ever want to write a book and you want some stories of King Kong that have never been written up.
Fascinated by King Kong.
Yeah, I was besotted with it.
I'm sure you knew Todd.
Oh yes, sure. So that was that in the 50s, Cod, Springbok Legion, that. And then the Treason Trial Defence Fund, 1956, yeah. And for a short time, I can't remember the reason and I can't remember the dates. It might have been between my banning orders when I didn't have a job because I was from that organisation out. And, you know, I had some, and I needed to work. I mean, we were always desperately short of money and terribly poor. I mean, Jack was a professional revolutionary. I mean, Jack was the epitome of what you would call a communist. A lot of people called him Jesus Christ, who were not political people, who said that's what Jack was, you know. I'm trying to describe a man to you. So, I mean, we were always desperately short of money, and I had to work. And a job came along in the Katie Kagan Memorial Fund to raise money for a nursery school for working women in the distributive trade. And I remember doing that job for not very long, but it might have been 6 months to a year, when I raised money for the Katie Kagan Memorial Fund.
That would have been in the late 50s.
I can't remember. I can't remember, honestly, when exactly it was.
Now, 1960 came along, and all hell broke loose, and people had to go into hiding in the state of emergency. What did you do? What did you
do? Well, our story is quite funny, actually. Jack was banned. We were both banned. Had been banned for a long time, since 53, 54. Jack was at a meeting where he obviously had no business to be. And the phone went, and it was Nelson Mandela on the phone. He didn't give his name, but I knew his voice. And he said, "Rika, I want to speak to Jack." I said, "He's not in." "When do you expect him?" I said, 11 o'clock. He said, "Well, will you give him a message? It's very important. Now, don't forget what I'm telling you." And he gave me a message that was gobbledygook, I mean, you know. So I mean, and he said, "Don't forget and goodbye." And he put the phone down. So I immediately wrote it out because I didn't trust myself to remember it because it was meaningless to me. And Jack came back and I gave him the message. And he said, "Oh my God, that means arrests." Now, up to then, we'd had raids. You know, these 2 o'clock in the morning, blah, blah, blah. And they'd gone round and taken books and looked for. And Jack said, "This message means there are going to be arrests. So I must go out and warn people. When will you be back?" He didn't know. So off he went. And he got back at about... Now, in the meantime, I decided to go around the house and see if there was anything we shouldn't have there. Like a pamphlet about the the potato farms or something. Jack got back at about 1:30. And he said, "Look, I'm instructed to go into hiding. So while I'm packing a bag, will you think where we go?" Well, it wasn't easy, you know. You can't go to relatives. You can't go to people who are in the same position as you are. You can't go to a bloody hotel. Not easy. Anyway, I decided those were the people we should go to. We'll try. If not, we'll try something else. So in very short time we took off, and they were more than responsive, absolutely come in. And Jack kissed me goodbye and he said, "Now don't contact me, I will get in touch with you somehow tomorrow." So I said, "Okay." I didn't have very far to drive home, and I went straight to bed, and at 2 o'clock that button was on the door. My son was... Where are we now? 1960. Spencer's now 41. What age was he then?
60, he would have been about 14,
30. 30. Not quite, I think. No, he wasn't quite 30. So,
police at the door.
Yeah, the police at the door. And I didn't make it easy for them, as one never did, you know, and skip their things under the door. And you're quite right, Mrs. Hodgson, if you're alone, they say, you know. Anyway, I opened the door and they said, Mrs. Hodgson. I said, yes. I said, we've come to arrest you. Well, you could have knocked me over with a feather. But they didn't have a warrant for Jack's arrest that night. You know how that emergency went. They arrested so many people and 10 days later, the rest, yeah. Well, the first thing I did was go and pour myself a huge big brandy, you see. And then, of course, I mean, we didn't know anything about an emergency. We didn't know anything about detention. We only knew you're arrested the next day, you're in court, so I put all my smartest clothes, my makeup, and my cigarette holder and the lot. And they went round and searched the flat for about 2 hours, and at 4 o'clock you were ready to move, and I said I'd like to make a call to my sister. No, not allowed. Then I went and woke up my son, and I whispered in his ear that if anybody asks where Daddy is, he's in the country, and I'm being arrested. And as soon as I go, Spencer, ring Auntie Lil immediately, you see. Big blue eyes look at me, yes. And then, of course, I broke down. Anyway, I'm off to jail, and I meet Ellie Weinberg taking pictures outside. His wife's inside. And there were the four of us, Helen Joseph, Violet, Philippa Levy, who only stayed the one day. She got out on a technicality the next day, which we all should have worked on, but he was the only one who did. Anyway, so that's where I landed in 1960, and Jack then went into hiding into Swaziland.
But do you know anything of how he went and how come you said that?
Well, I don't know how he went. I suspect he was taken. And then he learnt all the routes in and out. He took a lot of people in and out, and he saw people out like Adelaide Tambo out of the country, and so Adelaide and him stayed together for a while with her kids. He took a hell of a lot of risks in that time. He never got over this. He never got over it. He said, I'm never leaving you again as long as I live. Because we had a great love affair, as you may not have heard, but I mean, for 30 years we had the greatest love affair in history, you know. Nelson and whatnot had nothing on us. And he never got over that he buggered off and left me to be arrested. He couldn't believe it.
How long were you inside?
Only 5 months. I beg your pardon. 5 months was the length everybody. I was in for 100 days, just over 3 months. Huh?
Did Ruth take her children out?
No, I don't think so. No, she went alone. She wouldn't have wanted to disrupt the children from their schooling and that.
So Tilly would have taken her.
Absolutely.
And how long did she and Jack?
Well, she wasn't there for that long. Jack brought her back. I remember going to visit her in this incredible place. You know, life is funny, isn't it? And full of all sorts of things. When I married my husband, very shortly after, about a year later, we took a holiday with his three kids, who were at boarding school, who were not actually living with us. And we went to a very remote place on the south coast. A very cheap hotel, but very nice, you know, quite wild and lovely. And there were very few people there. And there was a very attractive man, bearded, beautifully spoken, with a gorgeous blonde woman. And they kept their distance, but they got quite friendly. We used to have it. I mean, there was nothing else to do there at night, you see. We had a lot of sort of, you know, these games you never otherwise play, guessing games, all this crap, you know, nothing else to do. Mostly they kept to themselves and took long walks away and, you know, didn't mix much. And we were quite happy to be on our own as well, but we got to know them quite well. But I never ever got to know their names. I was never introduced. And when I went to visit Ruth, guess where she was? It was at that guy's house. With a completely different wife who he'd had for years. A very interesting couple. Very interesting. They had about 5 kids. Lived way out in the country.
Whereabouts in the South Coast?
Where in South Africa?
Where in the South Coast was this?
Oh, God knows. So, about 50 miles from Margate.
Is this where she went, or did she go to his house in Joburg?
No. He was on holiday with this blonde. It was not his wife. And when I met him, I never acknowledged that I'd ever met him before. I think he might not have remembered me, I don't know. I think he was grateful, perhaps, that I didn't acknowledge that I'd ever met him before. He was an architect, and he was a wonderful potter, fantastic potter. He had this incredible home, and this very earthy wife. He made wonderful vegetarian foods and, you know, salads and all that. And I think Ruth and he had something going up there. I don't think it was possible in the same house, but I think he was very taken with Ruth.
What was his name?
Do you remember? I don't remember. I know his wife, though. She was an Indian woman.
So how long did she stay there?
Quite a few months, I think. But it was a lovely place to stay. See, Ruth needed... I mean, you've read 117 Days. You saw what happened with her and Victor. Did you?
Yes,
well. Yes. She needed that rapport with somebody, you know. She needed to be loved. Everybody needs to be loved. But Ruth, in a special way, needed it.
Because of her insecurity and her shyness.
Because of?
Her insecurity, perhaps, more so.
I think so. And I think, you know, you're more vulnerable when you're in a... I think, for example, I don't know, I'm just... This is just crap what I'm saying now, but, you know, this is what I think. I think, for example, when you're under... I think a man, when he's under pressure, I don't know so much about a woman, but a man, if he's having a tough time, I think he's more prone to have an affair than he would otherwise be. And so I think when you're most vulnerable is when you can most need that sort of somebody to come close to you, you know? I don't think anything ever came of this, but I think it was very good for her in that house that there was that kind of a guy, you know? I think it saw her sane through that period when she was so close to her kids. And she couldn't do anything about it. She just had to stay like a prisoner in that house. It was a lovely home. He'd built it himself. It was very superior, different, you know, quite wild, but very interesting.
Now, when she came out, I mean, when those people came out of hiding, it must have been a very tense time. They must have expected arrest.
No, I don't think so. Oh, maybe they did. But I don't think so. I have a feeling, but I'm not sure. I mean, you're into the media. I haven't really looked back on the newspapers, but maybe there was a promise for the regime that if they came out now, they'd be okay. The emergency was lifted. There was always the... There was always the fear, only after the emergency, of course. My husband, too, didn't return from... Well, he came to visit once, but, you know, undercover.
Mm. Vicar, that period between the emergency and Rivonia, was it a very muted period politically or very heightened political period? Because the ANC and PAC are banned, the Communist Party is banned. What was going on?
You're asking me about my flat now in Hillborough.
Well, yes, I mean, what's...
You know, Jack was the first person to make bombs for MK. Did you know that?
I didn't know that, but it doesn't surprise me.
You see, he had 2 very good qualifications. He'd been a miner, he was a mine captain, so he knew about explosives. And he'd been with the Desert Rats in the army. So he was quite an authority. And Jack had an ability to do anything with his hands. You know, if you broke a zip, Jack would fix it. He could fix the tiniest earring, anything that went, you know. And he had an ability and he had patience. He was wonderful with kids and he had patience. And so Jack started to make the first ones for Encontre. He tested the first ones. So people like Nelson were regular visitors to our home, Walter, Nelson, all those people. I mean, Jack was very involved then with the Congress Alliance and with, you know. And of course, so was I. I was very much an active person in Congress of Democrats.
Were you working in that period?
I always worked. I never ever stopped working. I mean, I went to work when my kid was 6 weeks old, you know, I went back to work. So I never stopped working.
When did you go for?
In 1961.
So was much of the planning for MK in those kind of meetings?
Oh yes, I'm sure, before, you know. And actually the bombs were made, the first bombs were actually made in my flat. I mean, Spencer was 14 and he was at St. Martin's School then, I think. Yes, he would have been at St. Martin's by then. And Jack used to mix them with a mortar and pestle on my dining room table. I had beautiful Fosa. You remember Fosa? Does Fosa mean anything to you?
No.
There was an organization in Durban called the Friends of the Sick Association. It was a TB settlement for Indian people, and they used to do this wonderful weaving. Curtains, tablecloths, bedspreads, the beautiful stuff, you know, handwork. And my sister was always giving me, I've got a very rich sister, that's Jeremy's grandmother, always giving me presents of these beautiful things. And I don't know how many of my first tablecloths were ruined by the acids from, and my carpets and my tables and so on. And Jack and Spencer one day were mixing this stuff, because Spencer was in the know, I mean, my son. And one of Spencer's friends from school came in, who was a pretty brilliant science student. And he said, "What are you chaps doing?" And Spencer said, "Oh, my father's just experimenting, you know, he's a great experimenter." I think Jack, was he under house arrest by then? No, not yet, perhaps. What's he mean? So this chap looks, he says, "But this is Condi's crystals, and this is gun, but Jesus Christ, you can bloody well make bombs out."
Security problem.
But he didn't think anything of it then, you know. Yeah, and I mean, those first trials of those bombs were terribly dangerous. I mean, Jack risked his life every time he went out to set off a bomb.
Did they have trials on nothing, just in the felt to find out if they worked?
That's right. That's right. And I mean, Jack came home one day with a car on fire. He didn't come home. He went straight to my sister's garage. He had a very good rapport with a man who worked for her. And he just put the hose pipe on it.
Now, how did he escape rebellion?
Well, we were already out of the country by then. We were in Botswana. Jack was told to leave. We had a special mission in Botswana.
Was that before the Rivonia arrest?
Yeah.
Was that just fortunate, or did you have an inkling that it might have been coming?
No, I don't know. I didn't have an inkling. I suppose Jack did, you know. But I didn't. But, I mean, by then Jack was under 24 hours house arrest. And we lived on the fourth floor of a flat in Hillborough. We were actually in a very unique position because Jack was the only person under house arrest who couldn't actually take a walk outside. We had no garden. And Kentridge decided this was good for a test case and went to court with it. And we won. Well, a house is not a home, or a home is not a house, or a flat, or I don't know what. And for 5 weeks, everyone in the Transvaal was released from house arrest. And then they closed up the loopholes in the law, and we went back into house arrest, yeah. Well, I was under 13 hours, but Jack was under 24 hours house arrest. I mean, we were so tired, you know, and Jack was obviously a very useful person. He was very good on security matters and so on. So we were asked by the movement to leave and to go to Botswana. Well, we had a specific role to play, but it wasn't a key. I mean, we had British passports, and after 5 months we were deported by the British.
To Britain? It was your job to receive people coming through to facilitate.
We did that, and we had other things to do, but I took an option on a farm there, and I'd already started growing things. We had never moved to the farm, but I'd started to grow a garden and so on.
Where was that, in Bilbatsi?
Which Barbara Castle always addressed us to, Lubotsky. She thought we were in Russia. But she did a wonderful job in fighting for us. You see, what buggered us finally was the perfumer up there. Well, because the British government, the Labour Party was winning at the time. The British government wanted to deport us. And the Labour Party, led by Barbara Castle, was winning our case for us to remain. We were very much in the news then. I mean, all sorts of, even Gordon Winter came over to interview us at that time in Botswana and so on. So we were winning. But then the perfumer affair broke. And in that period, everything else was knocked out of Parliament, knocked out of the news. And very quietly, we were then deported. I mean, before we were deported, we were asked to leave. And we said we couldn't.
So the British didn't want you in Botswana. They'd rather have you in Britain.
Favut was breathing very heavily down their necks. Everybody who escaped, Joe Slovo, the Goldreich and Walpi and Musa and Jasset, and everybody came through us, you see, and came to our flat and stayed with us and went on from there, you see. And we were an embarrassment to them. They hated our being there. And they wanted us out. And actually, we were not safe. I mean, finally, there was a big bid to kidnap us.
Winter could get to you, anybody.
Well, I thought Winter was in that team that tried to kidnap us at the time, actually. I can't be sure of that, but I think so.
How did you avoid it?
Well, we sat up all night with our African friends. They stayed with us the whole night, about 10 of them. And these 7 guys were outside. And they were waiting for everybody to go, but nobody went, you know. We kept them there the whole night. We were tipped off by a friend downstairs who was not a South African. He was not a Botswana citizen either. He was a Ghanaian, I think, or some odd thing. He was a photographer, a very good friend of ours. And he came to tell us that this car was downstairs from Pretoria and with these men. And they came up, they knocked on the door. They wanted to come in on some pretext, you know, and we didn't let them in. Anyway, all sorts of things were happening around then. I mean, that plane was blown up of Goldreich and Walpi, and Fish Kitsing's Land Rover was blown up. And the British were getting very windy. I mean, they didn't want an incident. And they didn't want us to go back to South Africa, because that would have been very bad for theirs, you know, security, if we'd have been taken back. And they tried very hard to get us out. So first they asked us to leave. And we said we couldn't, we didn't have the money, which was absolutely true. I mean, when we arrived in Botswana, we had £300. That was it, you know. So then they threatened us. Then they declared us PIs. Then the chief rep, who was then in Dar es Salaam, a man who's since left the ANC, phoned through and said to Jack, We're getting very worried about you. I'm sending you a ticket. And Jack said, I can't hear you. The phone is very bad. And he repeated, Jack said, no, it's impossible. I can't hear what you're saying, and put the phone down. Then we were, after having been declared PRs, we were then arrested and taken to court. Declared prohibited immigrants. And we said, we can't leave. We haven't got the money. So they then took us to court. There was a terrible man there, British, what would he have been called then? The administrator?
Commissioner?
Whatever, yeah. I suppose the commissioner. Chap called Billings. Terrible, pompous, stupid man. So then we were arrested and taken to court and charged with being there illegally after being told to leave. We could not find a single lawyer in Botswana who was prepared to defend us. So we went in to defend ourselves. And Jack knew exactly what was going to happen. This guy said, I know that you got the means to get out. And Jack said, we haven't. I mean, what are the means? And Jack was really twisting the lion's tail. I mean, it was really nice, you know. He couldn't say that he tapped telephones, you know. That was not on then. It's not on now, really, is it? But he couldn't say it. He couldn't admit how he knew that we could get a ticket to go out. Anyway, we were sentenced. I was sentenced to £30 or 30 days. And I think Jack was sentenced to £50 or 2 months. Oh, yeah. And we had a quick discussion. We'll go to jail. I mean, I thought a white woman had never been to jail in Botswana. It would be a real experience. But then our friends in the Bechuanaland People's Party paid our fines. Sometimes your friends are your enemies in a way, you know. I think it would have been a good experience. And during that period, this kidnapped attempt was on, and then the British very quietly just, you know, you couldn't, there were no planes then, proper planes. There were only these little four-seater planes that were private, what do you call them, chartered planes. And that's another thing, they were, I mean, we knew people who ran the company. A very strange man. If you ask me now, I couldn't tell you what his politics were or anything about him. And he was a pilot, or there was another pilot, a South African guy who we didn't trust, so we didn't know who would fly us out.
Or where they'd fly you to.
Or where would they fly us to. Now that's an interesting point. I mean, I've gone right off Ruth, and I don't know, this is just by the way, if you're bored, I mean, I can.
Well, I'm very interested in the Rivonian period.
Well, just to finish the story, you see, in our 5 months in Botswana, nobody ever spoke to us except African friends. Fish Kitsing was in the treason trial. He was actually a Botswana citizen, but had worked in South Africa. And Botswana friends that we'd met there, or people who'd come through from South Africa. But not one British person or one South African bastard ever spoke to us. We were treated like...
Right.
Absolutely. But one day, a woman who was very beautiful, she was enormous, but she was very beautiful, stopped us in the street with an Afrikaans accent you could cut with a knife. And she said, what's wrong with you people? The papers... Tell us, you bloody communists. God knows what I expected to see, she said. I don't know what communists are. I don't care, she said. You seem to me to be very nice people. Why don't you have a drink with me? So she said to me, you can have a drink. So I said, not in the hotel. I mean, it was only this one hotel. It was owned by a South African who was a real agent. And you know, all these... whoever, anybody, there was only that one place to congregate, you see. She said, of course in the hotel. I want people to see me drinking with you. That's the whole point of the exercise. You can come up to my flat. No. Now, she was the person who ran the telephone exchange. And she tipped us off that the phones were being tapped. That's why Jack knew that this chap Billings was going to happen. And she was really very kind to us. She got in touch with my sister, you know, all sorts of things. The second person who was ever kind or spoke to us was just prior to our deportation. And now it was known we were going within 10 days, you know. A very ugly man, also enormous, wearing khaki shorts, red face. I mean, really such an ugly boy, I can't tell you, from Southwest Africa. That was the days when. And he came into the bar one evening. Jack, I mean, there was, by then we couldn't eat at home because all our stuff was packed ready for going off, you see. I mean, then we knew we were going. So we had to eat at the hotel. There was nowhere else to eat. So he walked up to us and he said, "I'd like you to have a drink." Of course, we were very suspicious. "Who the hell are you?" And then he told us he's from Southwest Africa. And he said much the same sort of thing as this woman had said. "I don't know why people are so terrible about you. You look like nice people to me. You know, I'd just like you to have a drink." "Okay," Jack said, "we'll have a drink with you." He said, we had a drink with him. He said, "No, have dinner with me." "Oh, we were a bit reluctant." "Oh, please, have dinner with me." So we had dinner with him. He bought a bottle of wine. He was very charming. And he said, "Listen, this is what I really want to talk to you about. They're going to bloody deport you. You don't know where they're going to take you. You don't know who's going to ride that, pilot that plane." He said, "I've got a very good friend in Southwest Africa. He's a chemist, he's a Jew, and he's a pilot. Owns his own plane. If you should land anywhere other than where you're supposed to, get in touch with me. This is my name, blah, 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 and my friend will take you out." Well, I mean, I don't know if you land in the Bundus of somewhere or other, whether, you know, all this is possible, but it was a very kind thought. Then he wanted to press money on us. And Jack said, "Look, if you want to give me money for the movement, I'll take it. I don't take money for myself. We don't need money." "Oh, you bloody fools. I'm not interested in your movement. I'm interested in you." No. Anyway, we finished our dinner and all that and that and that. 8 o'clock the next morning, this guy knocked on my door. He said, "Rika, we're now on first door. Your husband's a bloody fool. Here, I want to give you this money." I said, "No, I'm sorry. If you say, we can use it." "Okay, but no." "No, no," he said. "All right, good luck, and don't forget if you..." Those were the two ever people, both Afrikaners. Huh? Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. But now Ruth stayed behind and got arrested.
Yeah, she stayed behind.
Why was she arrested?
Well, everybody was being arrested then. I mean, you know, also, look, even in the 1960 emergency when I went in, I mean, there were some very funny people with us, you know. Mm. There was a girl whose husband was a liberal with a capital L. When they came to arrest his wife, he said, "You're making a mistake. It's me you want." "No," they said it. I mean, she'd been in the party like 20 years before. I think she joined maybe 2 days before the party was banned. And she'd not done a thing ever. You know, she was one of the people who was arrested. You couldn't explain why they had a warrant for me the night of the 1960s and not for Jack. In those days they weren't so bloody cleared up, let's put it that way, or mistakes were easily made, maybe language problems, I don't know what, you know.
But they must have thought that Ruth was involved in rebellion, and she was, in those kind of meetings.
Are you talking about the 1960 now?
No, that's 63.
No, I'm talking about 60, yeah, huh? Yeah. Right.
I'm just jumping back to 63.
Right. Well, I don't know. You see, I'm saying to you, for anybody to have arrested me and not my husband was the biggest joke in history. Not that I wasn't involved, but I was not anything like involved as my husband was, you know. Yeah. No way. And so you can't explain these things. There is no explanation.
But you were inside for 100 days. Mm. And Ruth was inside for 170.
No, she was not inside in the 1960 emergency.
But later, I'm just saying.
She was arrested under the 90-day law, which is a different one later. It was a new law. Huh?
Why do you think she tried to commit suicide? from your own experiences?
No, our experience was quite different. We were 21, well, first of all I went in, there were four of us. Then there were two of us, because Helen was taken to Pretoria for the treason trial, and Violet Weinberg and I were left. Violet was a wonderful woman then, you know.
So you were never in solitary?
I was never in solitary, and then the other 19 women came in, so there were 21 of us. I mean, I can't say what it's like if you're in solitary or if you're bullied, and, you know,
but
it didn't happen.
Given what you know of Ruth, it seems such an unusual thing for her to do. Or is it not?
Look, I don't know if you know, my husband was a hardliner in many ways, and one of the things he was a hardliner on was on the question of people giving statements in jail. He didn't forgive that sort of thing, and he didn't think anybody needed to. He didn't think it was necessary, regardless. And I often argued with him on that, that you can't know. Every person is different, to which point a person can be taken for either psychological or physical torture. I mean, you just don't know. And there's some surprising people. I mean, Alfred Nzoa, I think, was a man who had a terrible time under torture. He never said a word, you know. But others speak before they've even had a clock on the head, you know. I can't say. I wouldn't like to. I wouldn't like to surmise on it.
Do you think she really was giving information, or just thought she was?
No. I don't think she either thought she was or was. I think she was afraid she might if she came to a breaking point. And I think her vulnerability and her guilt maybe about her children and, you know, you have a lot of time to think when you're sitting in a situation like that. No, Ruth, I think that's the whole point. She would have rather killed herself than say anything. No, she didn't certainly give anything away, and I think she was afraid she might. I think maybe she felt that her mind would go, you know. Or you don't know what they could do to you. Perhaps, you know, a clever girl like Ruth will think they only have to give you an injection of pentothal. Maybe they can get something out of you, you see.
What was her relationship to Victor? Strange.
Well, that's right, you see, because we didn't know enough until Ruth's book came out about the soft and the hard touch. And here was the man, they were all being beastly and terrible and horrible to her. And here was the man who was kind. Maybe she thought, that guy fancies me, you know, really fancies me. He might have.
Because he left the security service.
He might well have done. And certainly anybody like Ruth could have persuaded him, you know, that he was in the wrong job. Yeah. Yes, I think if he had a mind at all, and I think he probably did, and that's what got to her, you see. He was the only one who had something that, you know, related to. No, I'm sure there was something of an affair of the minds there, yeah, in her case, certainly.
He saw her,
and maybe that's what upset her as well, you see. How can you fancy a bloody special branch man? But in that vulnerable situation, you can. Look, even in jail, you know, you're so deprived, you know, you're young and you're healthy, and you see a man, it's a warder. But for God's sake, nothing has stirred you for, you know.